here this afternoon. If you've seen the agenda, you know that once again you are in the land of HIPAA.
It's another HIPAA.
If you're not here for HIPAA, I strongly advise you to leave now as quickly as you can. We are going to start. Danelle, you're down there. Who's supposed to be sitting here by me today?
Possibly me. Am I?
Are you going to sit up here by me?
Sorry.
All right, okay, because I'm sort of feeling lonesome. And without a little direction. We're going to, colleagues, this is, these bills are posted for work session. There have been. Is there one?
2309, we did not get a chance to hear last time if you still want to hold a public hearing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, when we get to 2309, then we'll have to do a public hearing, although we didn't post it for public hearing, I don't think. So we may need a ruling on that at some point. But let's spend our time where we know we can spend our time, which are the in the discussion of the amendments that have been prepared with respect to 2305, 2306, and 2307. What I would like to do, I think, is do I see Holly here?
She was here.
Yeah, Holly, do you want to help walk the committee through the amendments? And let's just take them in order. So I'll start by opening the work session on House Bill 2305.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council. And if muscle memory is true, I should be sitting there and having a whole different conversation. But I'll do my best from this side of the podium. What you should have in front of you are the Dash 2 amendments dated 3403, which is today. And they contain the Dash 1 amendments, which I believe this committee originally considered, and make a number of what I would characterize as minor changes to the 2305. To summarize, though, and I think as a starting place, 2305 is that one of the three primary HIPAA bills that deal primarily with health care providers and state health insurers. So the universe in which these amendments are being offered has to do with the use and disclosure of health information as it's regulated or as it's impacted by health care providers primarily and the state health plans, which would be the Oregon Health Plan. So that is the big universe in which these amendments are going. 2305, the Dash 2s, they add a definition of authorization which came directly from the federal legislation. That's page 1 of the amendments. The additional changes are some what I would call tweaks to the definitions. One has to do with the definition of healthcare providers to clarify that the transactions that are covered are part of the financial or administrative activities in connection with the rest of this, the transactions covered under this act. We also have added the term healthcare clearinghouse as part of a covered entity, even though currently Oregon does not have any. The other minor changes that are noteworthy in here have to do with a request by the Oregon State Bar Policy and Practice Act or section to address that information can be disclosed if there's a court order. And then finally, on page 3 of the Dash 2 amendments, there's language in there having to do with changing the rules of civil procedure. Oregon law allows the Council on Court Procedures to adopt rules, and then they go into effect on January 1 of an even-numbered year. What this amendment would do is have the changes to ORCP 44E, which has to do with medical records and exams, and 55H, which has to do with subpoenas, to be changed at the same time that this law goes into effect, which is good because they basically address the same issue. And so this way the courts and the practitioners will be on the same page in terms of how health information would be addressed.
Okay, thank you. So that's a description of both the dash one and the dash twos. Are the dash ones subsumed by the dash two amendments?
Mr. Chair, they are.
Okay, so we can discard the dash one amendments. All right. Are there questions by the committee with respect to what the dash two amendments to 2305 do? Okay, Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Holly, you mentioned that there was a definition of a medical provider in the dash twos, and
there's a continuation. Healthcare provider is defined in 2305, and on which would be on page, let's see, one of the bill, line 28. And then all we've done is, if you go to page two of the dash two amendments, it goes on to clarify that it's a health. Well, that's not the right place, actually. I lied. Hold on, let me put you in the right place here. If you look on page 1, line 14, where it talks about who's covered by the Act, it says a healthcare provider that transmits any information in electronic form, and then we added, and now this is on page 2, line 6, to carry out financial and administrative activities in connections with transactions covered by sections 1 to 7 of this 2003 Act. Which I think was the intent all along. It just spells it out even more clearly as to what kinds of activities that a healthcare provider is engaging in would be covered under these amendments, or under the bill, actually.
Okay. Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you. In relationship to the bullets that you have under the dash two, could you help me to this specific section that deals with add the section to the bill to enact changes to ORCP 44E and 55H?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that would be page 3 of the dash 2 amendments, lines 3 to 6.
Okay.
Did that answer your question, Representative Jensen?
Yes, thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
All right.
Now, just to clarify, these changes were, in fact, adopted by the Council on Court Procedure in December, and so all the legislature is doing is ratifying their actions and making them effective sooner than would otherwise be the case.
Right. You'll recall from the presentation committee from the Council on Court Procedures with their proposals, if we do nothing, the Council on Court Procedures proposals become effective
January 1
of 2004. Because we're adjusting the other parts of HIPAA, and specifically those two rules under the Rules of Civil Procedure are impacted, the idea was to advance the, not change at all anything the Council on Court Procedures did, but simply advance the dates by which those rules become effective to mirror when the HIPAA bills pass. So that's the proposal in the amendment. Yes, Representative Anderson.
Chair, thank you. You make reference to ads dental only. What lines is that on? Are those on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in the way that these bills were constructed, and to do what I would call Oregonize them and make them work in Oregon, we came up with a definite health insurer for the purposes of enacting HIPAA in this universe, and that's on page 3, lines 2 to about 2 to 10 of the printed bill. There was a request made by dental-only providers that they be specifically included on this list, and so in the same way that we've added, for example, other health benefit plans as described in 743-730 is sort of the universe of health insurance, major health insurance policies, I guess, would be more accurate. But then there are these other minor, other kinds of policies, short-term health insurance, student health, and that the dental-only folks requested to be added in, and so that's what that amendment does.
Great. Didn't see that. Thank you.
Okay. Holly, why don't you stay where you're at, because we're going to want to talk to you probably even some more about 2305. I'm going to look to Ms. Dayton. Who do you think would be are you the appropriate one from the work group side to come up and talk about the amendments at all? Or would that be you, or I'd ask Senator Bryant to come up, but I'm afraid that he wouldn't actually be able to talk about the amendments at all, knowing where he's been for the last 2 weeks, given his tan. So, but I'd certainly give you the opportunity, Senator, if you'd prefer to come up and answer specific questions about the amendments.
I'm afraid about the other question you might ask, so I think I'll stay here.
All right, good. So, Gwen, if you want to come up. And do you have anything to put on the record with respect to the amendments that Hawley hasn't already covered on 2305?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm general counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, but speaking today as a member of the Senate Bill 104 committee. The only thing I will put on the record is that the amendments that are before you today in large part are consensus amendments, amendments that were discussed by members of the 104 committee, either individually in the committee or with other interested parties as we met to try to bring the law not only in accordance with HIPAA, but recognize the interests and concerns of interested and affected parties. And so the 104 committee is supportive of these amendments.
Okay. Good. Mr. Lane, I see you're here in the audience, too. You want to come up real quick, Rick? You can stay, Gwen.
Thank you, Representative Williams, members of the committee.
Rich, my recollection is that from what you testified at about on 2305 that you had objections to, these amendments might not go all the way from where you wanted to be, but they do make some progress on some of the issues that you raised in your prior testimony. Am I right about that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, since we had our first opportunity to discuss HIPAA, there have been meetings held about some objections that I raised in my previous testimony. Those materials have been forwarded to other concerned members of the SB 104 committee for their consideration, as well as counsel. Those are not reflected in the proposed amendments that you have before you outlined in 2305-2.
But some of the issues with respect to definitions of health care provider and things like that have been addressed. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that is correct.
Okay. Okay. Are there questions for the by the committee of anybody on the panel? The challenge we have here, colleagues, is that given the effort of the work group and the time constraints under which we're operating with these bills, I'm certainly interested in trying to make this as good a product as we can. At the same time, I'm interested in trying to move the process forward. And so I, knowing what we're up against later in this month with committee agendas, the chair would be inclined, and I'm not going to rush the committee to this conclusion because it's going to have to be something you agree with, but the chair would be inclined to put on the record people's concerns about the bills as they currently stand with the amendments drafted, but continue to try to move the process forward and allow the parties to also work on the Senate side to determine whether or not they can make some of these additional adjustments in view of the Senate. If that happens, we'll obviously have an opportunity, as that bill would come back across the floor as amended, to revisit that as a committee if we felt it was necessary and we didn't concur potentially in the Senate amendments. But that's sort of my sense. And, you know, it's a tough issue, and I know that, you know, the committee is probably feeling, like all of us, a little bit on dry land here in trying to resolve that issue. But I'm interested in some committee dialogue, particularly when we have the three people, who, you know, sort of sitting at the panel who can answer some questions.
Mr. Chair?
Representative McPherson.
I'm adrift on these issues, and I say that with some disappointment because, in fact, my area of practice actually butts up against HIPAA, although I can't say that it includes it. In fact, I'm accused by some of my colleagues as having run for the legislature just to avoid having to get into HIPAA.
Guess what?
You showed them.
Joke's on you.
What? I kind of step back to kind of sort of broad principles, and I'd like to get some reactions from the people on the panel here to this. We have a federal regulatory statute that says that there will be certain privacy protections established as a matter of federal law, and obviously all healthcare providers who are within the scope of HIPAA protections have to abide by those. But what appears to be going on in particularly HB 2305 is a parallel structure state regulatory statute that is now designed to try to track with what's going on in HIPAA. And so I can understand the need, as is I think reflected in some of the other companion bills here, for Oregon statutes to be modified so that they comply with HIPAA requirements. But what I wanted to get some input on is why we're creating a state law parallel regulatory structure to the federal structure.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you would, Holly.
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, let me try to answer that question as the scribe, perhaps, of the SB 104 committee, as the drafter and the crafter of all of the bills. I think the best way to answer that question, particularly as it relates to 2305, is this. Oregon had or has currently ORS 192525 on the books. They have a state policy on access to medical records, and with some details in it about how and when records can be released, what are the circumstances, what an authorization form actually has to look like, whether or not you can charge for copying, that kind of stuff. So the Oregon legislature had already said, we believe that Oregon should have a state policy on access to medical records. Certain percentage of 192525 was preempted by HIPAA. And so the committee really had to make a decision. They could repeal it totally and not put anything in its place, and I think leave a vacuum, or say, we as a legislature had at one point enacted a state policy on medical records. We as a legislature, or we as the SB 104 committee, would like to give the legislature an opportunity to say, we had a policy then. We think it's okay to have a policy now. It may not be as far as the state. It may not have as many words as HIPAA does because we can't do that. But it's good to have a policy at the state level. That was one of the reasons. Because part of the concern, there were some people on this committee, and they described themselves as end users of the statutes. You know, the people that actually pull out the books and actually read them. And the other reason for doing so that was one of the reasons why. If you repeal 192525 and you don't replace it at the state level, when people go to an ORS and they want to know what's the state policy, they might not even know to go to HIPAA, because all they know is that something's been repealed and they don't know what's replaced it. And the committee felt fairly very strongly that it was important to have a replacement for 192525. And in a lot of ways, 2305 doesn't go any further than 192525 went. And in some ways, that's kind of, as a drafting perspective, is the beauty of it. There was an authorization in one. There's an outline of an authorization in the other. There's a basic policy about use and disclosure in one. There's a policy of use and disclosure in another. It doesn't go any further than the state already chose to go as far as medical records was concerned. Another reason why the committee decided to do this is if you look at the list of providers, and I mean, these conversations, I have to say, were torturous, and I'm summarizing hours here for your benefit, actually. If you look at the list of healthcare providers that's listed in 2305, which starts on page 1 at the bottom on line 28, and then goes all the way over to the next page, all the way actually over to diabetes self-management programs and any other person or entity, a lot of this list actually was covered by 192525. So there were all these people out there that were not doctors necessarily, who may have been massage therapists, chiropractors, pharmacists, dietitians, who had a place to go in state law to say, what's our policy on state records? And this list is pretty much the same. It grew a little bit because of HIPAA. But for all of those people out there that are regulated by this, who we don't, I mean, my favorite, of course, on this is the funeral services practitioners, which is actually, they were on the original 192525 list. All of these people out there, A, they need a place to go. What's the state policy on medical records? And B, and we had this debate a lot of times, there was some emphasis at the beginning of saying all these entities are regulated, let all of their regulatory bodies enact rules, go straight from HIPAA to regulatory to administrative rules. Well, when you have, let's see, we got to Y, so we have 25 different groups, and theoretically 25 different administrative rules attempting to enact what HIPAA did at the state level. And the concept of 25 agencies adopting administrative rules may not be the same. And the potential for chaos there kind of led everybody, as we went through this process, or if they went through the process, and I'm just taking notes, and going, well, maybe we don't want 25 sets of rules. That we want between the state level or between the federal level and the practitioner level some basic floor that says this is what Oregon law is. If you want more information, go to federal law. Obviously, some of this is going to have to be done by administrative rule, but there had to be a middle step. There had to be a middle ground between the voluminous part of HIPAA, taking out 192.525 and replacing it with something, and then all of these agencies who are now going to have to deal with this as well, who are going to have to be adopting some rules. And it seemed like the middle ground, the best middle ground under the circumstances for replacing and enacting a state policy on health records. Does that answer your question? I hope so.
No, it does.
You may.
But I would pose this question, which is when you take a federal statute that is as complex as HIPAA is, and then when you attempt to, in effect, restate it in state statute, you're inevitably, there are going to be departures in language which may or may not have substantive significance. And how satisfactory is that result as reflected in this bill? Because when I look at it we get some input. It's very difficult kind of reading, and we get input that there are some discrepancies or errors of areas of departure. How satisfactory do you feel this end product is as a reflection in Oregon statute of what a federal statute is telling us to do?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, let me try to answer that question in at least two ways. There are many circumstances under which federal law is enacted in part at the state level and then at the administrative rule level. And the first one that comes to mind is the state Medicaid program. I mean, there are, if you think HIPAA is voluminous, you should see all the Medicaid regulations. And yet we have state statutes that, in fact, restate, reenact to some degree what the feds have said that we need to do as a state vis-a-vis Medicaid. And then we also have tons of administrative rules. So that's one example. Gramm-Leach-Bliley is the second example, where the feds have regulated. There's been some attempt at the state level to say, here's our floor. I mean, for lack of a better word, I don't particularly like that analogy. And then there's also administrative rules. So I'm not sure that the process of having a three-tiered approach is unusual. And those are just the two that come off the top of my head. I don't draft in the area of foods and commodities and agriculture, but I think that's another area where the feds do a primary regulation. We have state law on it, and then there's tons of rules. So that in and of itself, to me, because it's done so commonly, I mean, Medicaid's a huge example. I mean, how we pay, for those of you, you know, how we pay nursing homes in this state, and that whole process clearly starts at the federal level. Parts of it have clearly been enacted in state law. The rest of it's in administrative rule, and some of it's even in policy. So the concept of the federal government enacting legislation, or in this case, enacting regulations, having some state law, and then having administrative rules, I think is fairly common. I mean, those are three off the top of my head in 30 seconds. If I sat here, I could probably come up with some more. So in that sense, it doesn't make me uncomfortable, because I think we as a state have done it, and I think most states have done it. Certainly in the Medicaid program, they've done it since the inception of the Medicaid program. That's one I'm particularly familiar with. And we have some definitions that are a little bit different than the federal definitions in Medicaid law, and it has not been a problem. As far as, you know, and I guess I will speak professionally at this point in terms of comfort level. I guess I would say my comfort level, I mean, one cannot control anybody's thinking. But I am very comfortable in the way that this bill and all of the bills takes the federal definitions and either, I've been trying to come up with the grammatical equivalent of paginate, but I haven't figured out what it is. We break our sentences into smaller sentences than the federal government does in their regulations. And some of this, that's all I've done. It's just taking the sentences and breaking them down into smaller chunks so that you don't have these run-on sentences.
And that is to your credit.
It's also a form and style thing in our office, and so I have no choice. But it does make it. I mean, ours are much more, I mean, we have many more letters and numbers, but it also ultimately makes it easier. I think, and so personally, having spent as much time with this as I have, I really am very comfortable with the way that Oregon has adapted this. I don't think that we are in conflict. I think there are places that we are silent, but I don't think that silence is bad. And for example, we have added, and I mean, I understand the rationale, healthcare clearinghouses to this bill. Oregon currently doesn't license any. So whether it's there or not doesn't add or subtract to the bill. Yes, it's in HIPAA, but an Oregonian who's reading the ORS doesn't necessarily, at this point, the clearinghouse doesn't apply to us in Oregon. So in a sense, the answer is twofold. I think that if we are silent, I think the gap is clearly filled by the HIPAA regulations. If we paginate or grammar, we break it up into more sentences, there has to be a word for that. I don't think we conflict. I am very comfortable, actually, having spent as much time with this as I have, is that our definitions, in fact, comport 100% with the federal definitions. And those that we have modified, I don't think conflict with federal law, and so therefore I think can continue to go forward, particularly if Oregon state law is silent on that subject in this particular case. We have not set up any conflicts, certainly no intended conflicts. But I think that the silence on some of these issues is not bad. And I think, I mean, as I said, healthcare clearinghouses, if our statute spoke to it or not, I don't think it would matter since Oregon has none. And if somebody were to come into Oregon and want to know how to, I mean, if a year from now someone were to come in and be licensed as a healthcare clearinghouse, then federal law would apply to them and we could ultimately bring them in. We change the Medicaid laws all the time. I mean, we change the statutes in reflections of the law. So I think in that sense, my comfort level is very high, and I don't think we conflict. There are certainly areas in which we are silent. I don't think that's bad, because, you know, the practice of health law, the use and disclosure of records in every state is going to be a little bit different. And, you know, I think that, in fact, the SB 104 committee did a good job of sort of finding that middle ground in this universe of, you know, from the feds to the administrative rules, where's the best middle ground? And I think that they've done a good job.
Representative McPherson, do you have other questions?
No, fine. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Other questions? We've lost Representative Barker. He's
Mr. Chair.
Made a run for the door. Representative Crowell.
If there is a conflict between state and federal statute, does federal statute prevail?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crimmel, yes.
Okay. And
generally, there's always exceptions, but yes, generally.
Okay. And then follow up?
Yes.
If there's, when there's silence on an issue, does that automatically default into federal statute as well?
Representative Crimmel, yes, it does. If there is no existing Oregon law, federal law will control. There's no question about that. So, for example, in the bills that we put together, there is not mention of the HIPAA patient rights provisions, at least in the 2305. There are in 2306, which is the insurance bill. And the reason for that is because the Senate Bill 104 committee viewed its task as looking at Oregon law for where there was conflict or where there was there were traps for the unwary, such confusion that perhaps practitioners and others could not maneuver their way through state and federal law in a very reliable manner. We did not, however, see it as our task to fill a vacuum in Oregon law with federal law. So, for example, there is no provider or patient bill of rights that applies to providers in the ORS. So we did not rewrite HIPAA into Oregon statute, but rather rely on HIPAA as the law of the land, Oregon and every other state in the union. And regardless of that is true regardless of whether it is written into state law or not.
Further questions, Representative Crummel?
One more, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And that is, under the healthcare provider, I just kind of have to ask this, and that is on page 2, line 38, Y. It says, any other person or entity that furnishes bills or is paid for healthcare in the normal course of business. So is that kind of the catch-all phrase that gets everybody else, that brings everybody else under HIPAA that might have been missed in the list?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, yes. And also, I think this is verbatim from HIPAA. This is one of those where we took all of their words and just threw it in there. So, yes, this is their catch-all to ensure that everybody would be picked up.
So, one more, if I may.
I may.
And that is, so is paid, that could be someone that's on salary. That I guess where I'm going with this is that with the athletic trainers in the United States, there's a lot of concern about HIPAA and compliance from a provider standpoint. Most of them, many of them, there are a number that work in clinics and that sort of thing, but many of them work in colleges and universities and for professional teams and that sort of thing. And they're paid salaries. They don't bill for their services. They're paid salaries and that sort of thing. So is that sort of going to draw them into this then and make these HIPAA rules apply to them that practice in the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I hate to sound like a lawyer, but the answer is it depends. And the reason it depends is because the universe of this, the starting point for HIPAA analysis is, are you a covered entity? Are you in this particular case, a health plan, a health assurer, or a healthcare provider that transmits any information in electronic form, et cetera, et cetera? So it really, in a lot of ways, depends upon who they're working for and how the information that they are collecting gets transmitted. And so that's where every analysis starts. Are you a covered entity? And so I don't know enough about trainers, but some probably may be and some may not be. But, again, that's where the analysis would start.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think it would be, and I'm just going to look at the three of you here and get your take on this. I think it would be fair to say that despite what we do on HIPAA this legislative session, that there is a reasonably strong likelihood, given the nature of these kinds of issues, that both because of changes at the federal level and in things that we experience in our own operation, that in the next legislative session there will be an opportunity to do a HIPAA too. Generally, everybody agree with
son
that?
Son of HIPAA, yes.
Son
daughter
of HIPAA.
Of HIPAA, please.
Whatever we're going to
call. No, Representative, Mr. Chair, this is perfect.
Yeah, right. Okay. Any other questions for the panel? Rich, we've got your testimony. Do you have anything else you want to add? I brought you up here because I wanted to make sure people could ask you questions. I want to give you an opportunity to not feel like we just brought you up here to be the potted plant. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you have my last sort of submission to the committee. I think my concern after hearing the explanation just now in response to Representative McPherson's questions about the HIPAA application, that by choosing as a policy decision to have omissions, then we're setting up a conflict in the fact that there is silence as to other duties and obligations. I understand the 104's committee's decision as a policy matter to only tackle the authorization statute and the other conflict provisions in 192, but we have nothing in the 2305, unlike the 2306, that at least points somebody who opens up the ORSs in the direction of federal law. And that it would be wise for a practitioner, a small care provider, to take a look at the CFR regulations regarding use and disclosure to have full familiarity of HIPAA's application on a state level.
Okay. And I appreciate you putting those comments on the record, Rich. Are there any other questions? Representative Shetterly.
Well, not a question, I guess, but just a comment. I'm sensitive to Mr. Lane's concerns, and if we were back several months ago, I'd like to flesh that out. But at this point, I think you're right as far as the time goes. What I might encourage would be further discussion of this as this moves across the Senate. And
right.
If there's any more development that's warranted, I'll bet it'd be something that would be received well here. But in respect for the work that the committee has done in the interim, and including the amendments, I just know how limited my knowledge is here, and I'm reluctant to leap into the middle of this myself and start directing traffic. So I'm inclined to go with the direction these folks have set. But with respect to Mr. Lane's comments, I hope that either as this bill moves forward, or at least perhaps in a couple of years, if there are gaps that we need to fill to make this work better for citizens of this state that are trying to use these statutes, that we'll be ready to fill those gaps.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure whether this is the bill to ask this on, but just so we get it in before we pass it up. I had a question from a local provider physician's office that was concerned that if his insurance personnel sent chart or insurance information to the wrong office, is there provision for a good faith mistake in here anywhere in any of these bills?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there is not a provision for good faith mistake in the sense that if you make an error in good faith, you will be immune from penalty. However, the federal government has indicated that the level of penalty or fines will be graduated so that an innocent mistake like you're describing that hopefully did not result in harm will not necessarily result in the same level of punishment as if on the flip side you're out there selling health information on the street corner.
Right. And the level of enforcement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this HIPAA will be enforced, at least currently, by complaint. It'll be complaint-driven as opposed to investigation or other affirmative action on the part of the government.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you all very much. Do you want to stay, Holly, the rest of the other?
I do, please.
And we may bring you back up later. Yes, Representative Jensen.
Are we through with this?
Oh,
you're
how
not
I
so lucky.
From your lips to God's ear, Representative Jensen. But no,
I had a question or two in relationship to section one of the bill, and I'm trying to figure out whether that was amended or not, and I don't see anywhere that it is.
In section one?
Section one.
Of the original printed bill?
Of the original printed bill.
Okay.
It is the policy of the state of Oregon that an individual has the right to protected health information of the individual safeguarded from unlawful use or disclosure, and the right to access and review protected health information of the individual. We got a bunch of individuals in here, and what is the relationship between all of these individuals? Are they one and the same, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, yes. Yes, they are. It's all the same. One person and that person's health information.
Okay. So the bill provides that policy of the state of Oregon is that the individual has the right to access and view protected health their protected health information.
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. The chair will move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2305. Is there any discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection? The amendments are adopted. Chair would move House Bill 2305 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Just wanted to state that I will vote in favor of moving this bill out to the floor. It's that vote is shaped largely by the fact that we've got a limited timeline we're dealing with here and imperative to come into compliance with federal law. And I think that same kind of timeline applies to probably this whole package of bills, and that I think there is an opportunity to keep working through this process in the other chamber or in the future to try to go into the details. But I just don't I feel incapable of parsing these details beyond what we've been able to do now and the timeline we have available. So I think it's time to move.
And I appreciate your comments, Representative McPherson, and I'll continue to work with the principals on these bills as well as they move over to the Senate and to try to provide as much help to the Senate. And if there are some additional changes that we can make that will buy some additional comfort for people as this process moves forward, that we can concur in when they come back from the Senate, that would certainly be the chair's preference. Appreciate your comments. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to support the bill, too, but I would like to make a note with the chairman that I need to do a little more of my own research on this because I have a bill floating around down in Human Services Committee and need to see how that interplays with what we're doing here.
Yep, that's fair. Thank you, Representative Jensen. Okay, Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Yes.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Jensen?
Aye.
Trumbull?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Zamsky?
Excused.
Federley?
Aye.
Chair
Williams? Aye. House Bill 2305 is amended and moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteers?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kuzanski's not here.
That's a good idea. Perfect. Floyd, that's what you get for going on vacation. Well, here's what we'll do. I'll go ahead and take 2305, because that seems to be one that there's some concern about, and I'll be happy to take 2305. But I'm looking for a bit more courage out of my colleagues when it comes to some of the others as we move through the process. So assign 2305 to me. And now we're going to open a work session on
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetterly.
After yesterday, I think Mr. Barker owes us a bill.
Well, he did raise his finger, and we're going to give him one too here before he gets it. And when I say raise his finger, I meant as an indication. So we're going to open a work session now on House Bill 2306. Holly, do you want to take us through the amendments on 2306?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to.
And be sure to put yourself on the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson, former counsel to this committee and currently with the Office of Legislative Counsel. To start with, just to refresh your memories, House Bill 2306 is of the five HIPAA bills, the one that is the longest, and it's also the one that deals primarily with health insurers. And The reason that the SB 104 committee made the decision initially to separate out health providers from health insurers was because there were significant laws already on Oregon's books related to disclosure of information by health insurers, some of which dealt with personal information and health information because of the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which the federal government passed some number of years ago. That's the law that's responsible for all those notices, privacy notices that you now get in the mail every day that are in two-point font and that you can't read, that come from your banks and your credit card companies and all those others. That's the genesis of that. 2306, as a bill draft, what it attempted to do was replace, again, in Oregon law, those provisions that were inconsistent with HIPAA, but also make it consistent with the Gramm-Leach-Bliley and current Oregon law, which is why it is structured a little bit differently. Oregon law already dealt with use and disclosure and access to private or health information by health insurance companies, and 2306 basically maintains that same structure. The amendments which you're considering today are the -2s, dated 3-4, and they are, I think, in their totality, with the exception of one piece, a reflection of amendments that were also adopted for the 2305. In terms of conformance amendments, there was language added by the that would allow somebody to, or make it clear that somebody can release information by order of the court. We modified the same definitions in 2306 that we modified in 2305, which was health insurer and health care provider. And the other piece that was added has to do with clarifying that there's nothing in 2306 that is intended to create a private right of action that didn't already exist. I don't believe that there are any other changes, there were no real policy changes in these sets of amendments. They're all basically carrying forward the amendments from 2305 into 2306.
And the -2 amendments do subsume the -1s, is that right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, so we're really, again, only looking at the -2s.
Correct.
Who from the Senator Bryant from the 104 committee do you want to put forward to talk about? Who? Molly, do you want to come forward? That's fine.
Hmm.
Mr. Chair.
Do you have anything specific that you want to add with respect to these amendments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, sir. I think that the one comment I have for Holly, I think she resolved already by her statement that under Section 18A of the O2 amendments, that the provision making explicit that this was not intended to create a new private right of action against a health insurer, that she clarified, as she just did in her testimony, that was the intent.
Okay, good. Thank you. Questions for the committee, of the committee, of either of these people? Rich, do you want to come forward on this one?
Yeah.
I'm looking for your paper. I think I might have left it in the last one. Did you have a... You were okay with the amendments on 2306. Is that right, Mr. Lane?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendments were reviewed and incorporated some of my original concerns, so I have no objection to that. The materials that you have attached that were recently circulated to the rest of the SBO 104 committee raised a couple of what I would characterize as definitional objections to 2306, and those are being considered now by the individuals that have received it.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Okay. Questions for anybody else? All right.
Just, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Sherwin.
Again, your preference would be to move this today, and
yes.
Again, if there are definitional issues that they can keep, they can follow this through across to the other side?
That is my preference.
Okay.
Okay, so if we don't have any further questions for the panel, thank you very much. We're in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2306.
Representative Shetterly moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2306. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? The Dash 2s are in the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I move that House Bill 2306 as amended with the floor of the due pass recommendation, and that Representative Barker carry it.
Representative Shetterly
moves
that House Bill 2306 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Go ahead and call the roll, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Cromwell.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Shetterly.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2306 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Barker, you're up for carrying this one?
I'd be delighted.
Yeah. I strongly encourage you to meet with Ms. Burns and talk about your speech.
Meanwhile, I'm meeting with Representative Nelson.
Yeah, Representative McPherson and Representative Nelson will be talking about it as well. Private joke, unless you were here yesterday. You wouldn't get it. All right. We're going to go to work session on House Bill 2307. And Holly, let's do it again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson, Office of Legislative Counsel. And you have for your consideration today the House Bill 2307-3 amendments dated 3403. These amendments, just in anticipation of your question, Mr. Chair, subsume the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s. They make a number of changes. The most significant changes, I think, were changes that were in the Dash 2s. Oh, let me back up. The universe of 2307 is the use and disclosure of protected health information in the public provider universe. This bill started out as an attempt to conform those statutes that deal with release of records at the state hospital, the Eastern Oregon Training Center and Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center, all of the community providers that have developed as a result of the closures of those institutions, and the Department of Corrections and their use and disclosure of medical records or protected health information. So the primary intent, one of the primary intents of 2307 was to conform those definitions as well. As drafted initially, 2307 did not bring forward the definition of personal representative that is in 2306 and 2307. 2305 and 2306. The Dash 3 amendments brings those definitions forward so that the same people that have authority under 2305 and 2306 to release, to authorize a disclosure, recent disclosure of records can do so under 2307. So that's one set of amendments that is in here. That's probably the lengthiest part of this. The issue came up last time in Section 3 of the bill as to whether or not a personal representative or a person appointed as a personal representative under ORS Chapter 113 could bring a lawsuit, and those amendments, those clarifications are in here as well. And the only other change... and these amendments came from the SB 104 committee and from the Department of Human Services with the concurrence of the committee.
Okay. Questions off the top for Ms. Robinson? Okay.
Chair?
Yes.
Just a question. Holly, under the definitions here, do school districts fall under this bill as well as a result of their provision of care to medically fragile special needs students? I'm just not sure. I mean, we do a lot in schools, and I represent a couple of districts, and I'm curious to know the extension of this. And obviously, the definition is broader than just a few state institutions, and I'm just wondering if you are of the opinion or if you know whether these definitions would extend even to something like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, as this bill defines public provider, I cannot imagine a scenario where it would go as far as into a school. It was what we attempted to do, to the degree that ORS Chapter 7430 covered a whole group of community providers. All we did was swap out one list for another. So if we did it well and we did it right, the answer to your question is no.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sheriff.
Then I guess for my own comfort, this isn't a situation where HIPAA might provide a broader definition that would encompass school districts, as far as you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, the intent of, because of FERPA, which is the Federal Education Records Act.
Sure.
I mean, that's the primary set of laws that deal with school records. So, no, this doesn't apply. But certainly 2307 does not apply to any way, shape, or form that I can imagine to a school district.
So what I think she's saying is you can keep your FERPA out of her HIPAA.
Keep your FERPA off of my HIPAA.
Well, you know, it is an interesting question, because, of course, I do understand, I do know the records law. But of course, districts also deal with medical records in providing care to medically fragile and other special ed students. And so there are records that are of both types, I guess, that are kept and maintained at districts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, to the degree that this would, if you had a child that was being served by a school that was living in a community program, the records that were being maintained by the community program would be controlled by this.
Okay.
How they would be able to use and disclose records into the school would be controlled by this, just like they are today before this goes into effect.
Right.
But that relationship won't change.
Can I?
Yes, Representative.
Follow on that with just a quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just to Representative Shetterly, but will there be any distinction in schools between those schools providing school-based clinics, health clinics, and those who do not?
That's good.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, the universe of 2307 does not go into those programs.
Okay.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, the follow-up question to that, if I may?
You may.
Is what bill will go into those programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kremel, this is good. This is the same answer I gave you before. It depends. If to the degree, I mean, in the analysis of school-provided health care, you have to go back to whether or not, I mean, you don't get into HIPAA unless you're a covered entity. The programs themselves are not most likely going to be covered entities. You may end up having some that are covered entities. But how you would do that analysis I'm not willing to do today. But school-provided health is a separate subject, I guess, would be the best way to deal with it.
So
I should look to the back for help or suggest that we
prefer. And Senator Bryan, you've been looking for something you know about to actually come up and talk to. Why don't you feel free to come up and...
I think it's wonderful. Senator Bryan has managed to put me on the hot seat so many times and turn about fair play.
Thank you. Neil Bryant, Bend, Oregon, chair of the Senate Bill 104 Committee. You have to do the test to see if you're a covered entity. And then if you are not a covered entity, you can breathe a semi-sigh of relief. But then there's also the issue of FERPA. And if it's an educational record, then you're excluded from HIPAA specifically. But if it's not an educational record, you're not. And so then the question is, what's an educational record and what might go beyond that? And that's something that will be wrestled with.
I want to see Ms. Dayton. Do you want to come up and weigh in on the? Go ahead and stay, Senator. You can stay for a minute, because this may be a colloquy about what constitutes a school record and when's a school a covered entity.
Well, for the record, I'm Gwen Dayton, Mr. Chair. I don't have a lot to add to what Senator Bryant indicated. That is the question, whether educational records under FERPA are excluded from HIPAA. So if you're talking about an educational record, then it's not subject to the restrictions or the allowances of HIPAA. If, however, you're not talking about that kind of a record, you would be subject to HIPAA. I can imagine a circumstance when you've got a school-based clinic and you have a nurse who is there providing care for students who might need it for whatever reason, that nurse and that clinic would need to comply with HIPAA. I would.
Have to comply.
I believe they would.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, right. Okay.
If that wouldn't be an educational record.
I don't believe so. I mean, we need to sit down and look at the fine print of FERPA, but I don't believe so.
Representative Krummel.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but if I may put my physical educator's hat on for just a moment. So I'm a PE teacher, and I have students that are disabled in a wheelchair, using a walker, whatever the case may be, and I've designed their educational program or the educational program to include them. And so that's the educational record. However they do in class, that's the educational record. So that's going to be exempt from the HIPAA requirements, even though you're dealing with health care, with health-related issues, because I've got them on a remedial program because of the fact that they wear a leg brace or because they're using a walker or whatever the case may be.
Right, Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, I think it's excluded from HIPAA because the gym teacher's not a covered entity. They're not a health care provider.
Okay, but then as soon as that child, same child, shows up at the, because they've fallen and hurt whatever made them disabled in the first place, and they go over to the nurse's office, and the nurse is a listed entity in 2305, actually, and so now it becomes a medical record that is part of HIPAA. So however that the nurse treats same student for basically the same problem, now that part of the record is a health record, so by a covered entity, so HIPAA would apply.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, Hall is shaking her head, but I'm thinking yes, because you've got a health care provider providing medical care to a student, generating a health record. And that nurse or whoever might, whatever provider it might be, would need to use and disclose that information in accordance with HIPAA. But Polly has a different point of view.
Well, I mean, thinking sort of out loud, Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, if the health care provider does not transmit that information electronically, then you have parts of HIPAA that would apply because it's one kind of health information but not another. So the answer is it depends. It's just, I mean, the schools are the fuzziest, I would have to say.
The school clinic,
by what's going on up here.
The school clinic would have need to have I'm searching for the right word, received or maintained electronic records,
right,
use standardized transactions. I'm fairly certain they would. They don't have to have transmitted that very record by electronic means, but they have to have received and disclosed, I'm not using the right words, information electronically in a standard format in order to be a HIPAA-covered entity.
May I, Mr. Chair?
Do you really need to?
Well, I guess to a certain degree, I'm trying to also sort of build the record here a little bit, because I think that if there's a big question about legislative intent, and particularly where the education aspects and the healthcare aspects, there is a huge crossover, and I know that we're really getting down to splitting hairs here, but what I would really hate to see is. We've got an athletic trainer out there that sees the kids in class during the day as a teacher and sees them in the afternoon, and all of a sudden they're in hot water because some data got transmitted that they had a hand in creating, or the school nurse, or some other person that's working with students in a sort of a bifurcated way.
Okay.
And so, then the next question then is with regards to the health record, and so now I'm a nurse we have a school nurse who calls the family doctor, and the doctor says, well, can you transfer your notes? So she goes on the internet or however she transfers it, and emails. Let's say she uses email and emails the record of her notes from that day to the doctor, so he can see what the status of the student was at that particular point in time. That's going to constitute an electronic transfer, obviously. I guess what I'm trying to get to is this, the school district then is going to have to take whatever steps they need to protect that information, and so that the student doesn't, in essence, file a complaint later on if for some reason they thought they were violated.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kremel, the short answer is yes. The important factor is not that they sent something electronically in that circumstance, but that they broadly engage in standard transactions. But in the circumstance you've described, the nurse can transmit the information to the physician. HIPAA allows that transmittal without express patient permission, as long as there are basic precautions taken to ensure that the doctor receives it in a secure location and you don't send it to the wrong person and all those things. So that transaction can occur, and the school district is just responsible for implementing some basic policies to make sure that nurse, when he or she sends it, knows where they're sending it and knows that the physician is receiving it in a secure location.
Okay.
And this is why we'll have HIPAA, too, it seems to me. Okay, thank you both. Holly, you stay put. Let's bring up, and maybe Gwen, were you going to be the point person for the 104 committee on this one? I want to make sure that we sort of follow the same format. Is there going to be somebody else that was going to come up? You, sir, look like you were you planning to be the 104 point person on this bill?
He's 2309.
He's 2309, okay. All right, so... Rich, you want to come back up again?
Thank you, Representative Williams. On the 2307 attached to my materials today were definitional concerns regarding both how HIPAA defines psychotherapy notes and what is not a psychotherapy note. The definitions inside of 2307 do not reflect that. That would be an example of that. I think those ought to be in the same shape if the committee is going to go forward with this planned policy approach. Also, on the healthcare services provider, HIPAA does include all of those covered entities, taking us back to the 2305 that we've been sort of using as the master to go forward. The narrowing under the use and disclosure in 2307 should be expanded to impact all of the covered entities, because it's going to apply to all of the covered entities as defined in the HIPAA standard.
Okay, thank you. Rich, are there questions? Okay, thank you. Well, colleagues, I think we're in the same general place on 2307 as we were with 2305. and certainly my position will be the same, that to the extent we can continue to work on these definitional issues as the bill moves forward, I'm going to be trying to assist in that as much as I can. Anybody else want to talk about this further? Then with that, the chair would move and the dash threes, I know you told me, you answered my question already, but the dash threes are the ones and the twos.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And the threes all together. Okay, then the chair would move the dash threes of to House Bill 2307. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? The dash threes are adopted. And chair would move House Bill 2307 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Okay, Nancy.
Ackerman.
Yes.
Anderson.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Hanson. Trummel.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Zanzi.
Shadow.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2307 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Ackerman?
I'll take that.
You want that? Okay, that would be great. All right. Representative Ackerman to carry 2307. And now we are at, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2309. We didn't apparently get to our public hearing on 2309, so I'm going to break with standard tradition, and I'm going to just allow... let me see by a show of hands who wants to testify and put some information on the record on 2309. I see a one. I got two. Rich?
Three.
Three. Satisfy you? I'm going to make you come up and put that on the record just for fun. But go ahead. So I've got two. Who was my third on 2309? Three. Okay. Why don't we have, are you, and you're the representative from the 104 work group committee, right? Let's start with you. You want to stand by? We'll start with you, and then we'll move on to other testimony. And I apologize for the approach. And Senator Bryant.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Neil Bryant again. I want to introduce Kelly Hagan. He is going to speak for the Senate Bill 104 committee dealing with 2309. And on this particular bill, we're going to present to you two alternatives and allow you to make a policy decision here as far as which way you might choose. Also, I want to assure the committee that we received Rich Lane's suggestions yesterday, and we're circulating those to our committee, and we will take a look at those and address them when they're on the Senate side. So I appreciate the committee's promptness and sending this over to the Senate because of the time, and as the chair pointed out, you will see this again because there will be probably a few changes on the Senate side. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Hagan.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Kelly Hagan, a member of the SB 104 committee. I apologize in advance. The testimony that I've handed out is mistitled HB 2308. It is intended to address 2309. As my colleague in the committee has already suggested, we're offering you some choices on this bill, and specifically with respect to Section 1, which deals with court visitors. The problem is that HIPAA does not allow providers to discuss their patient's mental condition without the patient's authorization. And so the court-appointed visitor who goes out to speak to physicians or psychologists or others familiar with the person's mental state have a court order appointing them and directing them to do that, but there is no legal compulsion directing the provider to respond to those inquiries. So HIPAA changes things. It raises the stakes for providers who are asked to comment on the mental state of their patients, because it would be a violation of HIPAA without some form of legal compulsion. The bill as written essentially finds the compulsion in the statute. The dash amendments that you have, dash 2, provides that compulsion either through court order or subpoena, or, of course, the patient's authorization. So the policy choice before the committee is What form of legal compulsion does the committee want to choose to provide so that providers can provide needed information to the court on the mental state of these protected or potentially protected individuals? The second issue in the bill concerns drunk drivers. Current law allows an emergency services provider discretion in whether or not to report to law enforcement an illegal blood alcohol level of some person believed to be the driver in a MVA. HIPAA, again, gums up the works in the sense that it does not allow such disclosures without the patient's authorization. So the compromise struck currently in Oregon law of providing discretion to the health care provider and of giving them immunity for making such a report is not a workable solution under federal law. This bill provides one answer of the two possibilities, which is to compel disclosure when the health care provider is aware of an illegal blood alcohol level. The alternative, of course, is to strike the law and to eliminate the discretion on the part of those persons to make a report to law enforcement.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Hagan? Kelly is the representative. Why don't you stay there as the representative of the committee? I saw two other hands over there go up. If you two want to come up, and I apologize, we don't have a sign-up sheet, so you'll just need to put your name and who you are on the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Wright. I'm a professor of law at the Willamette University College of Law, and I'm director of its clinical law program. I've practiced in Oregon as an elder law attorney since 1988. From 1988 to 1998, I was the statewide support person for elder law in the Oregon Legal Services Corporation, now Legal Aid Services of Oregon. I've been a member of the executive committee of the elder law section since its founding, and I am currently chair of the elder law section. But I am testifying today in my individual capacity, not on behalf of the section. I did submit written testimony the last time we were here, and I hope you all have received that and had a chance to look at that. I'm here to speak to the effect of House Bill 2309 on Chapter 125 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, which is the guardianship and adult protective services provision. The concern with the original version of the before the Dash 1 amendments was addressed in my testimony. As the original bill stood, it simply changed under the guise of putting HIPAA, bringing HIPAA considerations and making Oregon law consistent with HIPAA, it basically made a very major change to ORS Chapter 125, one which was subject to a great deal of debate and discussion in the 1995 legislative session, which I believe was the last major rewrite of Chapter 125. During that session, and I participated and testified at that in that process, it was specifically stated for the first time in Chapter 125 that the rules of privilege apply in guardianship proceedings and that physicians and other persons who hold privileged information are not entitled to release that information in the course of the proceedings unless there is a waiver or other reason why the privilege does not apply or if there is consent. And so the concern with the initial version of the bill was that basically it made an enormous change to Chapter 125 without getting any discussion or input from the people who actually operate and work with that statute. It went far beyond the HIPAA-conforming purpose of the bill. In fact, I wasn't even aware that that was the purpose of the bill until I arrived at the first hearing. I want to speak to both the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s. The Dash 1 amendments retain a concern which, because they imply, by adding the statement by court order, it implies a new authority of the court under 125 to order that privilege be invaded. There's no provision in 125 now that gives the court that authority. If there is no consent to disclosure of privileged information, then the court has the option, or the party, the petitioner who's seeking guardianship, has the option of asking for an independent medical examination under ORCP 44, and under certain circumstances may be able to subpoena medical records under ORCP 55. And so I would point out that the problem with the dash ones is it seems to create a new authority of the court in Chapter 125, which the court has never had before, again, going well beyond the purpose of conforming with HIPAA. As to the dash 2 amendments, I guess I would say, as the bill amended in the dash 2s, I would not testify in opposition. I would simply raise some considerations that I think are very important, and I think basically this is creating traps for doctors, which is rather the opposite of what I understood the HIPAA conforming bills to be intended to do. And I specifically want to refer to the reference to patient authorization, which is at, on the dash twos, is first referred to at line 2, and then again on page 2 at line 30. I'm mostly concerned with the Chapter 125 changes, obviously, but the same consideration comes up in the amendments to ORS 427. And this is that in proceedings where you're dealing with people who are allegedly incapacitated, or in 427, who are allegedly mentally retarded, the issue of whether that person has the ability to give authorization is clearly placed before the doctor. And the doctor has two choices. The doctor can conclude that that patient has the capacity to give consent, in which case the relevant information to the protective proceedings would be, I think this person has capacity, and therefore I don't see the need to invade his privacy by giving you this information. Or they can't accept that under Oregon law if they believe that this person, if they have reasonably believed this person does not have the capacity to give consent, then that consent is not effective. I don't know what HIPAA says about consent of the patient needing to be knowing consent by someone who is capable of giving such consent, but I know under Oregon law, simply the fact that somebody has taken someone's hand and made a mark on a page does not indicate consent. That has to be somebody who understood the consequences of their action and made a knowing choice to do so. So I guess I feel that the patient authorization creates a huge potential trap for doctors. I also, it's interesting, as I parse the dash twos, we're looking at, if requested by a visitor, a physician may provide, with patient authorization or in response to a court order, provide this information, court order, and then they cite ORCP 44 and ORCP 55. It's my understanding that if a court orders an examination under ORCP 44, or if a subpoena is issued under ORCP 55, there does not need to be a request from the visitor. In fact, the visitor is kind of irrelevant to that process. It's not a visitor who would be requesting those things. It would be a party. So I guess as it's parsed, it no longer entirely makes sense to me, because I don't see why the visitor's request should also be required before a doctor can respond to a court order under the two-sided sections of ORCP. But that's more of a quibble than a substantive concern. I just worry that the patient authorization, when you've got someone who has already been alleged and asserted to not be able to give such authorization because they lack the capacity, is creating a situation where doctors think that they're complying with what the law requires, but they are not.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the director of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And just as a point of reference, we're a health oversight agency under HIPAA. In the course of our work in the office, we work a lot with individuals being considered for guardianship and individuals who are currently under a guardianship. And I am just here to say that I support many of the comments that Jennifer Wright just shared with you. And our real concern in this is that we would not like to see a bill where the respondent would lose their medical privilege without the without that respondent having the ability to protect it. And that is why we do not favor the original bill. We do not favor the dash ones. And if we were called upon to support any of the renditions of that bill, it would be the dash two amendments. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Hagan, I'm going to give you an opportunity to respond to the issues that the two previous witnesses raised on behalf of the committee. Are you prepared to do that?
Yes.
Okay. Please
yes,
do.
Mr. Chairman. As you know, the committee is taking an agnostic position on how legal compulsion should be found in Oregon law. Let me recount for you, if I may, a few of the discussions that we had on this bill, and also a little of my own background. I chaired the Health Law Section Committee that sort of vetted the preemption issues on all of these bills and Oregon state laws, and this issue was first brought to the attention of our committee and the SB 104 committee by Bob Jundeff, who heads the Oregon Advocacy Center, which is an advocate for disabled persons. And in my own background, which includes a chairmanship of the joint OMA-OSB Committee on the Medical Profession, we actually had a rather spirited debate, somewhat emulating some of the issues discussed here, about how in actual practice these matters are handled. And the fact is that most physicians, most psychiatrists, most psychologists, when approached by a court visitor to get information about whether a person should have a guardianship created for them, will, in what they consider to be the best interests of their patient, discuss the mental capacity of that patient with the court visitor without the benefit of court order. That is a source of some irritation to some, and I can say from personal experience, representing many healthcare providers in my own private practice, sort of an incomprehensible problem to many of those in the healing arts, who view it as their primary duty to do what is in the best interest of the patient. In terms of the capacity issue, I frankly am sympathetic with the issue raised about the problematic nature of obtaining authorization from a person whose capacity is being put at issue. I will say, though, that the subpoena issue, although I'm not sure how that form of compulsion found its way into the bill, strikes me as odd simply because if there is a medical privilege here, that would be a defense to the subpoena under 55. And consequently, I don't see that as an effective approach. I think the committee is unfortunately presented with a couple of bad options. One option is, as the original bill proposed, to place the direction to the healthcare provider in statute. The alternative is to make the ordering of disclosure by the healthcare provider an ad hoc procedure that will require a court order or some other form of process in every case. It was the feeling of the committee originally that the judiciary already has its funding and capacity problems, and that given what seems to be the majority practice in physicians and other practitioners already, in a sense, ignoring the privilege being argued for here on my left, that the more efficient answer would be clearly to put it in the statute. But those concerns for the civil rights of individuals who are the subject of the proceedings is a real one, and consequently, the policy issue, I think, is kind of laid bare.
All right, questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative McPherson.
I'm not sure which member of the panel to direct this to, so I'll invite an answer from anyone. Is there the same timeline for action on this bill that we had in the previous three bills, in which we're essentially establishing broader administrative practices in order to meet an April date, or do we have time? Can we disregard that April date and try to arrive at a resolution of the policy issues that are presented in these particular situations?
Mr. Chair?
Because he represents the 104 committee, I'm happy to have you weigh in, but that seems like an appropriate question for Mr. Hagan to answer.
I think the short answer is yes, because as the statute is currently written, there would not be any specific procedure as part of the guardianship or commitment statutes by which you would apply to the court for these sorts of orders, and certainly the appointment of the court visitor while directing them to interview the practitioners doesn't force the practitioners to respond. So after April 14th, 2003, the issue is going to be, if this bill is not in place, will health care providers provide the information that are requested by the visitors? And if they do so, they would probably be well advised only if one of the parties or someone standing in the interest of the state were to apply to the court for an order that they do so.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I would agree with that analysis, but I would say that based on that analysis, the answer would be no. The concern is not with the HIPAA amendments. The concern is with an unhappiness with the way Chapter 125 is drafted. And that is an issue that should be taken up by the constituents and the people affected by Chapter 125 and not by under the guise of a HIPAA-conforming amendment. Mr. Hagan is correct. If after the effective date of HIPAA, doctors who provide this information without order or consent will be in trouble. And if that creates a problem in the guardianship process, that is a problem with Chapter 125. But the doctors have a clear direction they can go. They're not put in a bind where they're required to do something that they're forbidden to do, which is my understanding of the HIPAA-conforming amendments, to avoid putting doctors in impossible situations. They have a clear direction. It's one that some people are not happy with because they don't like the way Chapter 125 currently stands. But that is the law, and we're not really, my understanding is we're not here to change the guardianship statute.
Mr. Chair, if I could just recite what I think I'm hearing, which is that that HIPAA will become applicable to these areas of activity in April. And in response to HIPAA, practitioners in these couple different settings may start behaving in certain ways in compliance with HIPAA, which raises issues of conflict with existing Oregon statute, but which is not a HIPAA compliance problem. It's the HIPAA data is driving a potential then conflict between state and federal law.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, there would be no conflict under state law because nothing obligates doctors to speak to visitors under Oregon guardianship law. And in fact, and if you read the statute itself, as I pointed out in my written testimony, doctors may not speak to visitors if it would be in violation of the Oregon Evidence Code doctor-patient privilege. And sort of in support of that, this is a problem. It has been a problem right along. It's true. Doctors don't understand privilege rules. They're not some do, but a lot of them don't. They're not expected to. That's not their job. And that's why the committee that Mr. Hagan is a member of, the OSB-OMA committee, has actually drawn up guidelines for what doctors and lawyers should do so doctors don't get trapped. And what those guidelines appear in the bar directory, which is given out to every lawyer every year. It's kind of considered pretty important that lawyers know this. And what it says is, lawyers, you are not to ask doctors for that information if it's privileged. And it's not a law or a binding ethics rule or anything like that. What it is the OMA and the Oregon Bar Association getting together and say, well, how can we be fair to doctors and lawyers, and what is good practice, and what shall we agree to do? And that was the outcome. So it's not really an open question of what doctors should do now, though what doctors do is often not correct.
Representative Ackerman.
Let me try to get a couple of things in focus, for at least for myself. Is it your primary concern this afternoon about the medical privilege that the party would have that whose mental state might be at issue in a guardianship or conservatorship proceeding? Is that where we're coming from this afternoon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, that's exactly correct.
Okay, and then if we take that into the bill as originally drafted, the shall language would require the doctor to release information to the visitor, and that would violate the attorney-patient privilege. Is that your point?
The physician-patient privilege.
Physician-patient, you're right. Okay. And then as we look at the -2 amendments, you come up with two alternatives. Shall becomes may, but then may has to be in response to court order under ORC 4444, which would be the independent medical examination, which I think is rather cumbersome for this process. or a subpoena issued under ORC P 55, right? And it'll be a process, at least to get the information to the court or to the visitor.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, that's correct. And the point is, it's true that a privilege might be defense to subpoena, but the privilege may have been waived, or there may be other reasons why the material should be subpoenable.
Right. And but as I was reading through and trying to refresh my memory on how ORC 55 works, when you're trying to get medical exams from a third party or from another party, it does require, I think, 14-day advance notice to the patient and his or her attorney and the medical provider. I think that 14-day window gives them an opportunity to object or quash the subpoena. So under those circumstances, why is not the patient's rights adequately protected?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, I don't oppose the dash 2309 with the dash 2 amendments.
Okay.
I just wanted to point out the confusion I was worried about with the patient authorization piece. But I do think that the dash 2 amendments do protect and basically keep the status quo in Chapter 125.
I think the patient authorization is inherently contradictory in this process.
Mm-hmm.
Because if a person is incompetent and that incompetency is at issue, how can they authorize the release of information? So we have to have another process set up. But I'm satisfied with what I see in the dash 2 amendments. I think the subpoena process would work pretty well. Thank you.
Good. All right. Thank you very much. I've got another hand in the back. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I'm concerned about the authority issuing the representation.
Ma'am, you'll have to come forward and put your name and information on the record.
I'm Barbara Joan Hayes, and I'm a person that has been affected by medical misdiagnosis, and the issues you're considering right now. I'd like to know who appoints medical representatives to act for others. You don't define it in these pages. I don't have the original HEPA documentation here. But there's another consideration, too. Doctors can make false or inaccurate diagnosis. And sometimes this leaves a person without any due process. You haven't addressed that. And it is a reality sometimes in our system.
Well, we appreciate your putting your concerns on the record, Ms. Jones. I'm going to ask...
Hayes.
I'm sorry, Ms. Hayes.
Barbara Jones Hayes.
Barbara Joan Hayes. Thank you. I'm going to ask you to actually, if you would, I'm going to connect you with Holly Robinson, who was legislative counsel, who was up here talking about these bills, and have her maybe respond to some of your questions with respect to how the appointment process works currently within the statutes.
Well, that's not my only concern. My other concern is representation for a person that has been misdiagnosed. It was just accepted as fact that a doctor's diagnosis can alter a person's credibility and offer them no legal recourse to whatever the doctor decides.
And on that one, Ms. Hayes, I'm going to direct you to Mr. Richard Lane, who's in the back of the room, who represents the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, because that is, in fact, a responsibility that they would have in representing individuals where there is a misdiagnosis by a physician in a number of different circumstances. And I think he'd be most pleased to talk to you about how that process works as well.
Thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome. Rich, do you just want to come forward and put on the record what you had previously said about the dash or the 2309 with the amendments?
Thank you, Representative Williams. Members of the committee, in our previous submissions, we did have some objections to the 2309 as drafted. We reviewed the 2309-2s, and given the provision now for court order or consent, leaving aside whether somebody can actually complete an authorization given their capacity, leaving that aside for probably a different forum, the dash 2s, we think, allow the opportunity for the issue of the physician-patient privilege to be taken care of in another forum. So we don't have an objection to the dash twos.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Lane. Anything else, colleagues? With that, then, the chair is going to move the adoption of the dash two amendments to House Bill 2309. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, the dash twos are adopted. And the chair would move House Bill 2309 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, Nancy, would you call the roll?
Ackerman.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Arthur.
Excused.
Benson.
Excused.
Trumbull.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Kazansky.
Excused.
Aye.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2309 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Have I got a volunteer on that one? Representative McPherson. All right.
Got to redeem yourself.
Got to redeem yourself. We're nervous, but we figure you'll break your teeth on that crossing guard bill, so we should be in good shape. Senator Bryant.
Mr. Chair, I will leave with the committee a sample of the notice of privacy practices that will be given to every patient in the United States, or should be, as of April 14th. So the next time you see your doctor, you're going to get probably many of these in the mail.
Lawyer. Great.
Pages.
It is five pages.
Oh.
And you'll also get notice from your insurance company.
Who is responsible for this?
Donna Shalala. Okay, thank you very much, committee. We're now adjourned.
Oh, thanks. She was a dozer.